Okay, there's fire in the hole. Alright, let's see, where's my April 1st? Ready? Five, four. Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 1st, 2018. And here to give us a great big April Fool's joke is Mariah Tinger.
Oh, yeah. Well,
you got nothing, right?
I wish it was a joke.
And we're joined by Mr. DR Tucker. How are you doing, DR?
Very well. How are you doing?
Good. Good. No, April 1st is a great day for kids to put salt in the sugar bowl and that kind of stuff. But I don't know. I wish I was happier. Anyway, this April 1st, we're into spring. It's Easter. Everything's looking up. But we have to look back and talk about this past winter, in which the city of Boston saw several heavy-duty storms that happened. Of course, since they were long-duration storms, they happened to overlap with high tides, which brought water into downtown Boston, essentially flooding the area around the aquarium, if you're familiar with downtown mm-hmm. Boston in that section. And really brought home to many, many people the imminence and inevitability of rising sea levels. That it's not something that's going to happen in 50 years. It is happening now. We are now seeing the effects in Boston of sea level rise due to climate change. Mm-hmm. And that has shaken a lot of people. And this past week, within the last 10 days ago, or 10 days or so, the City Council of Boston held a hearing where they solicited information and comments about how Boston should begin to adapt, be resilient, get ready for these kind of storms that are coming in the future. And so let's just put aside for the moment the question that I always bring up of the moral balance between adaptation and protecting yourself versus mitigation, reducing your carbon footprint so that everyone gets protected by having a cleaner air. Let's put that aside for a minute and talk about what Boston might be able to do to address the fact that the sea levels are rising, and not just in downtown Boston. It's all up and down the coast, where there's lots and lots of people. If you know the Boston area, there's lots of people on the shoreline, from the South Shore to the North Shore, that are seeing repeated flooding due to these storms. So, did you catch any of that that hearing or commentary around it?
There was a great piece in the Boston Herald about the hearing, in which the Herald noted that, quote, climate experts warned Boston city councilors that the cost of preparing Boston for climate change could be as high as $2.5 billion, even before a seawall to protect, you know, the most vulnerable regions of Boston. According to the Herald, the price of elevating land and retrofitting older buildings is expected to come between $1 billion and $2.5 billion. And Mayor Marty Walsh said it would have to be a combination of state, federal, and private dollars to sort of pay that massive, massive amount. And it just, it just makes you realize once again that if people think it's, you know, the old saying, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. If you think paying to reduce emissions is expensive, try not paying to reduce emissions.
Right. I mean, the bill is coming due that all of a sudden you're looking at a several billion dollar kind of investment to try and address these things. And it's because everyone has been ignoring the issue. I mean, I think I saw something, correct me if I'm wrong, DR, but that there is a proposal floating around to build a seawall, literally mm-hmm. a seawall across the entrance of Boston Harbor. So I think if you've ever been, again, if you're familiar with Boston Harbor, if you're not, get a map out, but there's a whole sequence of islands in the harbor, which only in the last couple of decades have become a national park, and it's absolutely gorgeous, right? If you've, mm-hmm. you guys ever been out there? I mean, it's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
We've
beautiful.
Got camping out there.
Yeah, yeah. And to build a seawall across there would, I mean, aside from the aesthetic damage it would do because it's such a beautiful area. I mean, the very idea that we would spend $20 billion to protect Boston Harbor with something that would probably have to be replaced in 100 years seems ludicrous, right? I mean, I mean, those things are out there. We're now actually talking about that as a realistic option, although quite an expensive one. I think the mayor said there's no way we're going to get the money to spend build a $20 billion wall, right?
Well, I have an idea of how to get the money. You know how Trump talks about building a wall and having Mexico pay for it? Why doesn't Boston, you know, similar to how New York is suing the fossil fuel industry, sue the fossil fuel industry, build mm-hmm. that wall, and have ExxonMobil pay for it?
There you go. Go for the deep pockets. Nice. Yeah, wouldn't that be a good idea?
Yeah. I mean, you know, here's the thing about seawalls, right? It's not like if you build a wall, the ocean is like, oh, right, you don't want me? I'll just, you know, head back. I'll just go back into the atmosphere. That water goes somewhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this comes back so often to environmental justice issues, but there's a lot of areas in Boston which already do have, you know, aqua fences and seawalls around the buildings, right? There's I forget what building it was around, but there's an aqua fence that they put up when the, you know, water rises, but mm-hmm. just because it doesn't go to that building doesn't mean it disappears. It goes into another building. And more often than not, it's going to go to a community that can't afford to build a seawall. So you're you know, back to poor communities being disproportionately affected by climate change. And even as Boston is sort of talking about these really expensive initiatives, there's all the city has is guidelines for sustainable building practices, not binding requirements, according to the Boston Globe. And so I think there's the Seaport Square development, right? 7 million square feet is in the process of being constructed. Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Okay.
Right? That's a whole big project that's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's getting a lot of criticism for its abundance of non-permeable hardscape surfaces, right. Which, you know, cause more damage and more flooding trouble. So
what's a hard, impermeable hardscape? What does that mean?
Right. So, I mean, we're talking about, you know, roadways and sidewalks that don't allow water to drain through them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there are some good plans out there for rebuilding the seafront in ways that, you know, can accommodate effects of climate change with surfaces that allow water to, you know, absorb water. But instead, we just keep – but these surfaces maybe would only be able to be a park and, you know,
but I mean,
instead
is,
we just
– Is that – I mean, I have this image in my head. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is that – you know, 100 years from now, when the sea levels are higher, Boston will have a rather verdant expanse along the water of parkland, which people can go to on a sunny day. But that will be a major mechanism for damping down waves and kind of allowing the water to seep back, the incoming tides to seep back into the ocean. Is that a fair picture?
Yeah, that's not just a vision in your head. Actually, I've seen plans from the city of Boston that do just those sorts of things, but they're just not viewed as, I don't know. I mean, at least it seems that they're not, that it's sort of like, oh, well, that might be a little extreme is sort of the gist I got. I could be wrong about that, but I know that those plans exist. Those sort of ideas of how we could rebuild the harbor so that it was more climate resilient, but instead we're just sort of doing business as usual, the same things we've always done, and then instead we're going to build a big wall that's going to push the water somewhere else.
Right. But I mean, I guess I not to beat on this too long, but I mean, I could foresee most of the shoreline where there are houses on the shoreline. So for your $20 billion seawall, you can buy a lot of houses in Nahant and Hull and places that are directly affected, right? So you make an equitable deal where you get properties that are right on the water, get people out of them because it's not sustainable, and turn that into some kind of a buffer zone where when a big storm comes, you've got some separation from the living spaces to the ocean. It seems to me that, well, I agree with you, Mariah, that everyone kind of blows it off. It seems much more pragmatic than going out with building a big cement wall out in the middle of the water. I don't know.
Right. I mean, and it'd be great if we did that before there was some sort of a disaster that didn't make it an option, right?
Right. If you do it in advance, as to DR's point, you do it in advance, then you can sort of plan it as opposed to reacting to it after the fact. Well, mm-hmm. Anyway, so there is that, and I think that, so the city council had a hearing, they got an earful from several kinds of people. It's clearly, the meta message for me is that people are worried about what's going to happen, because they've seen a bunch of damage and storms this year, and they're on the case. One of the things that our governor did, Governor Baker, after the storms, he went out and has now proposed a bill to provide some money for remediation of the areas along the coast. But it's not clear. I mean, I can't defend the bill or attack it particularly because I'm not up to speed on a lot of the details. But I think there's some amount of money for adaptation on the coast, but not the sort of coherent planning where we, at the scale and urgency that I think we need to address the issues of sea level rise. I don't know, DR, do either you see enough of that to make a thoughtful comment about what Baker is proposing?
I mean, I just know that I have, the little I read about it was that there's $300 million out of that $1.4 million bond bill that are slated for critical infrastructure and the prevention, adaptation, and mitigation of climate change. And, you know, it piggybacks on an executive order that Governor Baker signed in 2006 mm-hmm. that creates a climate change commission to begin the process of evaluating the state's resiliency needs. There was some suggestion, it was talked about, but not in any definitive way, of sort of what you were saying, a state buyback program to acquire properties in vulnerable areas. And that might be something that could arise from it, but it's not, it's possible under the current language, but it's not necessarily
right.
Has not been proposed.
Well, I saw something, I don't know if you saw it as well, DR, that Senator Mark Pacheco, who has proposed the noble and wonderful bill called Act for a Clean Energy Future, which everyone should call up their senator and urge them to support the Pacheco bill. But Senator Pacheco himself had a problem with the Baker plan because he didn't think it went far enough or wasn't a big enough scope, and that the Baker plan included some more energy for natural gas expansion, right? Which is directly opposite the whole point of the exercise, right?
Exactly. Pacheco wrote a piece for WGBHnews.com in which he noted that the bill doesn't include a coastal buyback program, which he writes, quote, would allow the state to economically acquire certain vulnerable properties and use the property as a protective barrier in the worst of times. And then he continues, quote, another serious concern with this bond bill involves the administration's language on energy resources, as you note, that the clean peak standard as part of the bill would allow the administration to define natural gas as a clean peak energy resource, which Pacheco writes, quote, flies in the face of two true proaction, protection, and transparency, end quote. And Pacheco's criticism of that, it goes other criticisms of this bond bill, which is that it does virtually nothing to try to reduce emissions. There's no real mitigation in the bill. There's just a largely adaptation, right. But you need both.
Right. Well, I mean, so dear listener, there is a lot going on around climate stuff in the city of Boston, in the state of Massachusetts. And it's a lot of it's in reaction to the recent weather, and a lot of it's in reaction to climate hawks who've been out there pushing the idea that we shouldn't be building new pipelines and that we should be trying to address this this issue. But speaking of pipelines, one of the interesting and important things that I wanted to touch on in our discussion tonight, which is actually fairly interesting, is the following. I'll just set it up, and maybe DR, I'll ask you, or Mariah, I don't know if you've read much on this, but yeah. There is a suburb of Boston called West Roxbury, of which I used to be a citizen many years ago. And in West Roxbury, it's a fairly dense suburb, one of the early suburbs of Boston. In the last couple of years, Spectra Energy, our friend Spectra Energy, who's trying to build pipelines all over the place, decided to put a pipeline through the middle of this rather densely populated area and was building the pipeline, which of course brought out a lot of opposition from local people. Part of that opposition was to go each morning to a new set of people would go and basically commit an act of civil disobedience by lying down in the path of the pipeline. And in fact, I think it was August a year ago, there was the coffin protest where they actually got down in the trench and laid down next to the pipeline that was being laid in order to make a protest. And they were all arrested. They all went to trial. And that trial happened recently, right? So do either of you want to pick up the ball and tell me what happened at the trial?
It sounds like the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office dropped the plans to prosecute the remaining. They were called the Resist the Pipeline. That was the name of the resistance effort. So the DA's office dropped the plans, which actually, from what I read, they were disappointed. The defendants were disappointed because they really wanted to go to court and present the climate case in court. Mm-hmm. And it sort of seemed to me like the DA's office said, witnesses are you going to produce? And they said, we've got James Hansen and Bill McKibben. Mm-hmm. And, I read something that said shortly after they heard that, they said they weren't going to prosecute. I think there was also something with Spectra Energy saying that they had a safety plan, and then it came to be known that they actually didn't have a safety plan. So that was some of the reason why also they downgraded they sort of give a slap on the wrist to all of these defendants.
Well, is that DR? Did you hear? I heard a story similar to that, which I can tell, but you correct me if I'm wrong. Is that the way I heard the story was that the defendants wanted to use what is called the necessity defense. And we've talked about in our legal seminars here, we've talked about the necessity defense, which is basically saying that I had to break the law for a greater good. So the evil that mm-hmm. I did by breaking the law is outweighed by the benefit of my having broken the law. It was necessary. And there's all kinds of conditions around claiming a necessity defense for having broken the law. Mm-hmm. And the way a very smart lawyer told me the following thing, that the defendants wanted to use the necessity defense. And part of what they did was to go to Spectra and say, tell us your safety plan. And Spectra said, I'm sorry, we don't have a safety plan in case the pipeline blows up. Right. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden now the necessity defense makes a lot more sense because these people are at risk, and they say, I got to lie down in the street here and stop this pipeline because if it blows up, there's a danger. And, look, the Spectra Pipeline Company doesn't even have a plan. Right? So mm-hmm. when that happened, all of a sudden the DA realizes that the necessity defense has more legs than originally he thought it might. And at that point, they say, we'll just basically charge you all with a civil charge and not a criminal charge. So it's kind of mm-hmm. like a parking ticket and you can all walk free. Is that the kind of thing that the way you understand it, DR?
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. And the judge in effect ruled I've seen two phrasings of the judge's ruling. The judge essentially finding the remaining defendants either not liable or not responsible for the civil charges, even though it's been reported in some circles that the judge said that they were not liable or not responsible by virtue of the necessity defense. There was a spokesperson for the court who told the UK Independent, that they were not found not liable or not responsible on a necessity charge. So it isn't really in the traditional sense of what we think of as a necessity defense case. This wasn't really a necessity defense case. And as you note, that the defendants were disappointed that by virtue of the change of the charges from criminal to civil, they were essentially deprived of the opportunity to try to mount a bona fide necessity defense in their trial.
And there's no precedent. Yeah. There's no big precedent here that can be used later on.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I got too, is that, and I think it heartens me to hear that there's all of these cases that are coming up where defendants, cases are where climate change advocates are starting to say, actually, the science is so robust, we want to take it to court. We want to be given a chance to fight with it. You know, we want to be able to put the necessity defense out there and show how it actually really does correlate with carbon dioxide emissions and everyone's right to, you know, common air that's clean.
Right. Well, I think that this sort of defense is particularly important, I think, now, because I think it was on Think Progress I saw that basically a lot of states are increasing the penalties for this kind of civil disobedience. So the people, I think the valve turner guys out in North Dakota, right? The states are defining oil pipelines as critical infrastructure. And if you mess with the critical infrastructure, you're now a terrorist. You're not a good citizen, right? And so that raises the stakes a lot. And so these kinds of legal defenses become more important. And the fact that at least while there's some ambiguity about how profoundly important a precedent this is, if it's a precedent at all, it's a ruling that I think will support other people trying to do similar civil disobedience acts in the future. I should just note that I can't pull up the name right now, but the Climate Workshop podcast, I'll put a link, that is Tim DeChristopher and Marla Markham, who are local people here in the Boston area who are leading these sort of the brain trust that is trying to work on these defenses for civil actions. God bless them, and we'll put up a link to, I'm sure they will have information on this so people can listen to it. So I think that we got to stop there. We're at 21 minutes. We've already outlived our time here. Let's see. We'll put up links to most of what we talked about tonight so you can catch up on all of the interesting stuff. That'll be at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on the Evil Empire of Facebook at /massclimateaction. Don't delete your Facebook account until you listen to this show. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, and Apple Podcast, etc. Almost any of these streaming services now you can find us. We'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Mariah, thanks for all of your wonderful input.
Thank you.
And we will talk to you all again soon. Take care. Have a wonderful springtime. Bye-bye.
Very cool.